All right. Well, we are in, if you happen to be a visitor or weren't here last week, we're in Matthew chapter 5. Bob taught class for me last week, and Bob, I never asked you how far you made it. I sort of had an idea in my mind how far I thought you would make it, so I know where I'm starting. Maybe I should ask where you think I should start.
We did not get to cover it.
Okay. Well, and that's what I thought would happen, so... Okay, excellent. So we're in Matthew chapter 5. I want to backtrack just a little bit. I want to go to verse 17. Because verse 17 really sets the stage for the rest of this, the message that Jesus gives through the rest of these next three chapters. So Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. And so as Jesus teaches here, what we see is that Jesus here teaches things that to the people seemed new. But what was the issue there? Should it have really been new to them? Is anything that Jesus is teaching here new?
New. It's just that they didn't have the right attitude or understanding of what it really meant.
Yeah. Remember, Jesus is the Word, so... The law that was given in the Old Testament, that was in some way Jesus. And so he is in many ways the personification of the Word. So when Jesus comes and here teaches about some specifics about the law and the prophets, really what he's trying to do is he's trying to tell the people, I know this is what you've heard, but this isn't really how it's supposed to be. And so as we go through these things, really what we find is that Jesus is kind of in many ways contradicting the teachings that the Pharisees had been giving to the people. The one that was covered last week was that of murder. And so the thought there was that, well, when did you commit murder? Well, you committed murder when you killed someone. But what was the message there in verse 21 through 26?
Well, your action starts in your heart.
Yeah. And actually, that'll be the message that we hear a couple of times is the issue starts in your heart. The final act, while yes, that's the sin that's being spoken of, there are other things that as we get to that final act that are important, that we need to be paying attention to. And so let's go to, again, we're backtracking just a little bit, but let's go to James chapter 1. And if somebody would, let's read verses 14 and 15.
But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desire and enticed. Then when desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning.
All right. So the issue here that we see is verse 14, each one is tempted when he's drawn away. All right, so is the temptation an issue? No, the temptation is not, it can be an issue, but it's not the beginning of sin, is it? What is the beginning of sin? Well,
acceptance of the temptation.
Yeah. When desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And so, Jesus here in Matthew 5 is telling us somewhat of the same things that James later on says, that sin is conceived in your mind. That's where it starts, and then when you start taking action on it, of course that's sin too, but it begins in the mind. So murder, while is the final act, really what does it start with? Well, it starts with hatred, doesn't it? That's what it...
But sin... talk about sin can happen without it starting in the mind. For example, murder. There's all kinds of people that have been murdered when it was not conceived in the mind of the murderer. It was a reaction.
Yeah. The
rage or whatever.
Yeah. The teachings, though, that the Pharisees were, it seems as though the Pharisees were given was, well, you can think all you want as long as you don't act on it.
Yeah.
And that's not really true either. And That really becomes true when we start talking about adultery, and that's what we're going to spend the next time. Well, we might talk about this the whole time. I don't know. Let's look at verse 27 through 30, and let's start talking about adultery. So if somebody would, Matthew 5, 27 through 30, if you'd read that for us.
You have heard it said, I don't have my glasses, so I'll try here. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Here is the second time that Jesus has gone back to one of the Ten Commandments and really started there. So, you know, we see that with thou shalt not murder. Now we have what being talked about? Thou shalt not commit adultery. And so Jesus says here, you have heard it said of old, you shall not commit adultery. Right? Is that true? Absolutely, that's true. Jesus doesn't change this, doesn't say, well, that's not true. He says, but I say to you what?
You shall not commit adultery in your mind.
Yeah.
You don't even start thinking about it.
That's right. If you look after a woman or look after a man, if you look after a person of the opposite sex and you lust after that person, you have committed adultery in your heart. So, is this some kind of new teaching? No, it's not any kind of new teaching. Let's go back to Psalm 66. And I think I want to read verse... I think I just want verse 18. Psalm 66:18. If I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear. This is one example, this is one place we can go back and look in the Old Testament that helps us understand that this is nothing new. God did consider the iniquities that were in our heart that we didn't take action to. Was it acceptable to lust in the Old Testament under the old law? No, it wasn't acceptable. But the message that the Pharisees had been given was, as long as you didn't take action on it, well, it was okay. But that's not the point here. Jesus says, if you lust after a woman, you have already committed adultery with her in your heart. This is that idea of forbidden fruits, right? Comes from Genesis, when here is this fruit, whatever it happened to be, that the woman sees and that Eve sees, and what does she say?
I think she says we're not even supposed to look at it or touch it or something to that effect.
Yeah, but what was going through her mind?
It was beautiful.
Yeah, it was good. It looked good. It would make you wise. So you see, the thought process starts happening, but yet it's forbidden. And so we see a number of examples in the Old Testament, and we can think of our own examples too, of times where here is this forbidden fruit, this thing that you're not supposed to have, and then you start thinking about it.
Don't you think the reason Jesus brought all this out was the fact that if it's okay to think about and consider these things, well, that's what breaks down your resistance.
Yeah.
The more you consider it, the closer you get to doing it, and eventually you will.
Yeah. Let's look at a couple of examples. Let's look at Genesis chapter 39. Somebody read Genesis 39 and 7. Someone else go to Judges 16 and 1. And then someone else go to 2 Samuel 11 and 2. Yeah, Genesis 39 and 7, I believe.
It came to pass after these things that his master had their eyes
All right, so here we have the story of Potiphar's wife. And we don't get a lot of information about this, but we know that Potiphar's wife cast her eyes on Joseph. We get this idea that she longed for Joseph. And when we read the story, when did she take her opportunity?
When her husband was gone.
Yeah. And who else was gone? Pretty much everyone else, right? So we can, just because we know how people operate, was she thinking about this? Oh, absolutely. It started in her mind. She started dwelling on this. And maybe, we just don't know, but maybe she created that situation where it was just her and Joseph alone in the home. All right, let's go to Judges 16.
Now Samson went to Gaza and saw a harlot there and went to
him. So Samson had probably, Samson had a big problem desiring those things that were forbidden fruit, right? Because who was his first wife? It was a Philistine. Was he supposed to be marrying a Philistine? No. Why did he marry her? Well, because she was beautiful. It seems to be the only reason. But here, Samson sees a harlot, and what does he do? Then he goes to her. Samson is just one example of lots of people we could read of in the Old Testament who see harlots and think, oh, yeah. They start dwelling on it, and then they commit adultery. All right, 2 Samuel 11 and 2. All right. Read verse 3 there.
And David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Ephraim, and the wife of Uriah the Hittite."
All right. We know this story. There's lots of things we could talk about it. You know, David's men were off at war. Why wasn't David with them? David gets up in the night. He walks on his roof and he sees this woman bathing. And instead of turning away and going back to bed, what does he do? He dwells on it. And then he takes action, doesn't he? Then he's like, I wonder who this woman is. And so he sends for inquiry. And then we know how this ends up. So here's just a lot of examples of how adultery and sin in general, but adultery begins in the heart. So what's the solution that Jesus offers here? Yeah, so how are we supposed to take that?
Control.
It's about control. So if I have a stealing problem, should I be cutting off my hands? If I have a problem with lusting after women, should I poke my eyes out? It's a lot about don't put yourself in those situations. But are we really supposed to take this literally? Are we supposed to mutilate ourselves? I don't think that's what the Lord is saying, and I don't think that's what we're supposed to understand. I think we're supposed to understand that, one, don't put yourself in those situations, and two, control yourself. Think about Psalm 1. Let's go look at Psalm 1, because it shows the progression, right? Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, stands in the paths of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. That first verse gives us the progression that, you know, the person who doesn't walk with the ungodly, well, you're sort of moving through them. Well, stand in the paths of sinners. Now you've stopped. Or sits in the seat of the scornful. Now you're commingling. Don't put yourself in those positions. The person who is blessed doesn't do those things, doesn't put themselves in a position where they're surrounded by sin to where they're tempted by that. Dwayne?
We have an example, I think, in the Old Testament about plucking out the eyes. What that means, I believe it's David that said, "I made a covenant with my heart."
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's a good example. Other comments on this? I have one other thing I want to mention. So Jesus makes this commentary about committing adultery in your heart. And then I think Peter references it. Let's go to 2 Peter chapter 2. Oh, 2 Peter. I'm looking at 1 Peter thinking, why doesn't that make sense? All right, 2 Peter chapter 2. Let me read starting in verse 12. But these things, like natural brute beasts, made to be caught and destroyed, speak evil of the things they do not understand and will utterly perish in their own corruption and will receive the wages of unrighteousness as those who count it pleasure to carouse in the daytime. They are spots and blemishes, carousing in their own deception while they feast on you. And this is speaking of false teachers. But then notice verse 14. Having eyes full of adultery that cannot cease from sin, enticing unstable souls that they have a heart trained in covetous practice and are accursed children. It's a very interesting phrase that Peter chooses to use there. Having eyes full of adultery. I think probably Peter, when he writes this, is thinking about this message that Jesus gives, that this is the example of people who are just willingly giving themselves over to sin, that their eyes are full of adultery. When they see something, when they see some evil, they just lust after it.
And then the other one is their heart is trained in covetous practices.
Yeah.
So they train themselves to covet these things.
Yeah. All right, let's look at verse 31 and 32. And if somebody would, let's read that. Sometimes you'll see verse 27 through 32 combined together as being one topic. And I think as Jesus presented it, it probably was one topic. We're going to look at them slightly separated. But somebody read 31 and 32.
It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery.
All right. Oh, sorry.
And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery.
All right, thank you. So we've just got done talking about adultery, and now we've moved into this topic of marriage and divorce. Remember what Jesus says at the beginning of these previous two topics. You've heard it said, and then what does he do? Well, in the previous two, he quotes from the Ten Commandments. And now he says, furthermore, you've heard it said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Is Jesus doing the same thing here? Is he quoting from the old law? Absolutely. I think we just have to establish that absolutely that's what's happening here. In fact, that passage is, I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 24. It's interesting that there's quite a bit more said there about that topic. If you look at verses 1 through 4, it says this very thing. If you divorce your wife, give her a certificate. And then it goes on to talk about some of the laws of divorce that if... we'll just use Emily and I as an example, since I know we're good. But if Emily and I were to get divorced under the old law, and Emily remarry someone, and that man give her a letter of divorce, well, Deuteronomy 24 says that she and I cannot get remarried again. You know, and it's funny. I had an employee at work who she and her husband have been divorced and remarried. Well, divorced twice and remarried twice. And I think, didn't you learn the first time that this didn't work out? That's the point that was being made back in Deuteronomy. What's the point that Jesus is making here? You've heard it said that if you want to get a divorce, give your wife a letter of divorce. But what does Jesus teach on? What's the reason for divorce? Just because you don't like your wife anymore?
Adultery.
That's the issue here. And that's why I think sometimes we see the previous topic and this topic combined together. But I say to you, whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality, adultery, causes her to commit adultery. How is it then that we could cause her to commit adultery? Well, remember, the assumption here is that this woman is going to remarry again. And if you've put her away for some other, if she's been put away for some other reason than adultery, when she remarries, it appears that it will cause her to commit adultery. Because then it says, whoever marries a woman who is divorced also commits adultery. It's very interesting. At the Memorial Day meeting this past weekend, John Lee was asked to give a lesson called the letter. It was letter to the church, and the premise of his message that the congregation there at Murray Road had given was, John, if you were going to write a letter to the church today, what would it include? A very interesting lesson, and he talked how almost all of the letters had some positive things to say and had some negative things to say. And so he said, if I was to write a letter, then I would have some positive things to say. And he had two or three things positive. And he said, I have some negative things to say. And one of the negative things to say was about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. That this is an issue in the church that he sees as something that we just kind of gloss over. The Bible is very clear here that this is the reason for divorce. And this is a hard issue for us to deal with socially, particularly when you have individuals who, as much as our heart yearns for them because they're in an abusive relationship, the Bible doesn't give allowances for that. The allowance for divorce appears to be sexual immorality, adultery. And yet, with that, what else do we know about God's view on divorce?
He hates it.
He hates it. That's right. Let's go to Malachi chapter 3. Malachi chapter 3, really, let's start in verse 13. This is I mean chapter 2. I think I wrote chapter 3 down as well. Malachi chapter 2. Yeah. Malachi chapter 2. Let's look at verse 13. And this is the second thing you do. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, with weeping and crying, so he does not regard the offering anymore, nor receive it with goodwill from your hands. Yet you say, for what reason? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously. She is your companion and your wife by covenant. But did he not make them one, having a remnant of the Spirit? And why? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, heed your spirit. Let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. For the Lord God of Israel says that he hates divorce, for it covers one's garment with violence, says the Lord of hosts. Therefore, take heed to yourself, to your spirit, that you do not deal treacherously. What's interesting here is that what did God say through Malachi just prior to this? Well, that they had profaned this holy institution of marriage. And how had they profaned it? By marrying people who were outside the children of Israel. And yet, God says, that's not a reason for you to treat the wife of your youth treacherously. And he goes to the point of saying in verse 16 that he hates divorce. And why does what's the explanation for why God hates divorce? Okay, so right, there's probably a lot of things mentioned here. But there in verse 15. God wants godly offspring. There in verse 16, though, God hates divorce for, what's the reason there?
Covers your garments with violence.
Huh? It covers
your garments with violence.
Divorce is usually pretty ugly, isn't it? It usually is pretty ugly. I know there have been many a divorce that have been amiable, but for the most part, when we look at divorces, they're not that way. You get people who once loved each other now fighting and bickering. And it's just it covers your garments with violence. All right. The only other thing that I wanted to say about that was something that's alluded to here in Malachi 2, talking about marriage. When we think about the establishment of marriage, what do we think of? We go back to Genesis, the second chapter, verse 24, where it says, man shall leave his father and mother, join to his wife, and what? They shall be one. And then Jesus later says, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. But so, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on that unless there's some other comments on that. Yeah, so
I think one of the reasons that Christ said that was because under the old law, women were so dependent on men to survive, to even live, that they almost had to be married. And you know, if you're married, then you're going to have relations with your wife or your husband. Just the way it was. Not that there might not have been very rare exceptions, but it's not like it is today as far as being able to survive on your own.
Yeah, there was, women were at the time were much more dependent on men, which may be the reason why it says there, if a man puts away his wife for some other reason other than adultery, that you cause her to commit adultery. Yeah. Bill, did you have a comment?
Well, I find it interesting that at least seven times Jesus says in this chapter, but I say, and there's a message there that he's bringing to them, even though these problems existed in all through the ages, he's preparing them. We might compare it like literal fact that circumcision identified the children of God. But now, under the Christian dispensation of time, it's going to be a circumcision of the heart. And it's a whole different concept. We're going to be able to express ourselves and serve our Lord out of an attitude of desire, out of an attitude of faith. And underlying all this message, I think that's the basis of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not just about this, it's about really everything, isn't it? No longer is it going to be a law of sacrifices, the law of physical things. It's now transitioned into a lot of spiritual things, things that dwell within us instead of just the things we do outwardly. Because could you have been a good Jew and been a good Jew just outwardly? Well, at least in the minds of how things were being taught, oh yeah, you could do your sacrifices and all of that, but what was the message that Samuel delivered to Saul about sacrifices? What was it? Better to obey than to sacrifice. So the point there is, you could do all of the rituals and still not be obedient. Well, how is that possible? It's possible because you're not obedient in your heart. Yeah.
I was thinking, many times Christ references our relationships with one another to our relationship with Him. And so obviously the church is described as the bride of Christ. And it's a long-term commitment to Him. He died for the church. He's a part of it there. And likewise, our marriages should be long-term commitments, just as Christ's relationship is to the church, one that never ends.
Yeah, there's the perfect example of Christ's relationship with the church is the marriage. And I am intentionally not talking a lot about this topic just because we could spend this class and the next five classes talking about it, because there are a lot of uniqueness to every situation, and the truth is you have to look to the Scriptures to find how to make the Scriptures apply in that situation, as opposed to make your situation apply to the Scriptures, which is sometimes what happens. All right, let's look. We'll finish with looking at oaths. Someone would, let's read 33 through 37.
And you have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair black or white, white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one.
All right. It appears as what was happening was that people were taking oaths. We don't really use the word oaths today. What would we call that, really? Yeah, it's like I promise. We wouldn't say I take an oath. We make an agreement. We make promises to people. And it appears as though that what was happening was people were trying to one-up each other. At least, I don't know. When I read it, that's sort of what I see. You've heard it said of old, you shall not swear falsely, but perform your oaths to the Lord. And that had sort of been morphed into this idea that you can swear, you can take your oath by various things. And depending on what that thing was, would depend on how obligated you were to fulfill that oath. To the point that people were taking oaths on their own head, which seems interesting, right? We hear people kind of do that, right? They say, you know, something along the lines of, you know, they swear on their own life or maybe on the grave of their mothers. And people still do this kind of thing today. They take an oath, they make a promise, and it appears as though what was happening was people were just taking oaths on various things. And what's the point that Jesus is trying to make here?
I think that all of this comes down to trust. Is that we make oaths, we make promises because there's a degree or a measure of distrust. And to overcome that, we swear, we make an oath by something greater than ourselves. And so the root of the problem is we should be so trustworthy that when we say something, we don't need to cover up any distrust.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the last topic that we talked about, the adultery thing when you were in Malachi. He says, you have broke the covenant. In other words, he says, she is your companion and your wife by covenant. You took a covenant to make her your wife. God takes covenants very serious, but a lot of people don't.
Yeah.
Like, well, I made a covenant, but I signed on the line.
So Eric talked a little bit about trust, but I think there's another T word here that is the underlying issue. What should our speech be? Our speech should always be true, shouldn't it? We should always be truthful. We should always be trustworthy, honorable. So when we say something, our word should be as good as gold, isn't it? If I say I'm going to do something, you can count on me to know that that is true and that you can trust that that thing is going to happen. You know, for a while I caught myself saying, well, I'm telling you the truth, as if to say that at other points in time in my life, I wasn't telling you the truth. And that wasn't the case at all. I don't know, it's a weird habit. I'm telling you the truth now. And we have to be careful. We're accountable for the words that we say. We're accountable to the agreements that we make. And if we agree to do something, what does verse 37 say? Let your yes be yes. If I'm going to do something, you can count on me that I'm going to do it.
I was just going to say it's easy when someone is wanting you to do something. It's easy to say, yeah, I'll do that, when you know in your heart you're probably not going to do it. And we ought to have the discipline to say either no, or I don't know if I can do that at this point in time or not. And don't commit until you know whether you can or not. And the person may not be real happy that you don't do it, but if you say you'll do it and you won't do it, then you really lose all credibility.
That's right. The church is the pillar and ground of what? Of the truth. And so, if truth can be found anywhere in the world, truth is going to be found in the church. The church is made up of people. And if the people of the church aren't truthful, can the church really be the pillar and ground of the truth? The world will look at us and say, you don't keep your word on these things, why should I believe you someplace else? Jay? Yeah, kids are pretty smart, aren't they? They figure out if they misbehave in the grocery store or Walmart or wherever, and you're like, you're going to get it when you get home. And if it doesn't happen, they remember that. And if you as a parent don't keep your word, we are teaching our children that it's okay to not keep our word. Yeah. Yeah, maybe the moral there is don't say one more time, I'm going to knock you to the ground. We're coming up on an eye for an eye somewhere, I think. Yeah. Okay. Kevin?
As I read through these, one of the words that comes to mind is hype. Hype versus simplicity. Mm. You know, there's a lot of hype here. I swear on this, I swear on that. Today we're living in a society that's full of hype.
Yeah.
We don't need the
hype. Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's a real good practical application today. Yeah, don't build something up to what it's not, or tear something down. Yeah. Bob?
To me, the word is integrity. Every member of this church should have a high degree of integrity, and integrity comes from doing what we talk about right here.
Yeah. All right, we'll pick up with going the extra mile. Oh, look, an eye for an eye is the next verse. It is verse 38. Look at that. Yeah. So we'll pick up with that next week. We'll take a short